So we're continuing on with the talks on the four steps of meditation, looking at the noble Eightfold Path, which is the fourth step. And when I look at the Eightfold Path, and certainly when traditionally in a lot of commentaries they look at it this way too, there's sort of three sections to the Eightfold Path. There's what I'll call starting out, or as I put in my note, heading in the right direction. And then there's the section on practice in the world. And then there's a section on practice on the cushion. And interestingly enough, the Buddha starts with this starting out. These two keys to the whole thing, which sometimes called right understanding or right view. That's the first step. And the second one is called right intention, right motivation. You see different translations. So what I want to talk about tonight are those first two steps. And this is like how we make sure we're headed off in the right direction. And I'm going to stick with the word view tonight, because I like that better than understanding. It's like understanding is sort of passive. View is actually an active thing where we're looking out and seeing things. And I like that thought, that way of thinking about it a bit better. And I want to read something from the sutta here to start. And this is the Buddha talking about the importance of view, of right view. This is from the 117th sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. Oh, this is where you begin with right view. And how does right view comes first? One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. Seems a little reductive, but he's making a point that there's such a thing as right view and wrong view. And what, bhikkhus, is right view? Right view, I say, is twofold. There's a right view which is affected by taints, partaking of merit and ripening in acquisitions. There is right view that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path. So here he's differentiating between relative reality, and so which is the world we function in on a day-to-day basis, and this right view there, and then also an absolute reality, this noble, taintless, supermundane view is also important. And then he goes on and he says, and what, bhikkhus, is right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening in the acquisitions? There's what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and results of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are in the world, good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declared this world and this other world. This is right view affected by taints, partaking of merit, and ripening in the acquisitions. I want to say a little bit before I go any further about this word taint. And it isn't like we hear the word taint, we think this is like bad. Somehow taint is bad. And it's not that this is bad, it's just that when we live in the world of relative reality and we function in the world of relative reality, we're functioning in the world of the three poisons, you know, desire and aversion and delusion. So, and everything from that point of view is tainted. Okay, so here we have this list, this fascinating list. And I want to go through it. The first part of right view in the world is generosity. This is the constant theme of the Buddha. He keeps coming back here over and over and over again. How generosity, the necessity of giving freely. And this wasn't just so that, you know, he and his monks could live. It was that generosity gladdens our hearts. When we act in a generous way, I don't mean just like with financial resources, but generous in the broad sense. When we act generously, our heart opens. It's an open-hearted thing to do, to act generously. And that's that. When our heart is open, we're heading in the right direction already. We're heading off in that right direction. Just because our opening our thoughts and our actions to someone other than ourselves, we're going out into the world in a positive way. Then in this list, he then mentions, and then come the results of good and bad actions. This is what he's talking about here, is an understanding of the laws of karma and reincarnation. You know, we need to understand this. This is, if we're going to have right view, we need to understand that our actions of body, speech, and mind, every one of them has consequences. There's no such, once any act of where we actually form an intention to do something. So I'm not talking about, you know, someone taps your knee and your foot jerks, sort of automated things, but anything where we've actually had an intention to do something and then followed through. All of these acts of body, speech, and mind have consequences, and these consequences shape our lives. Right now, they shape our lives, you know, and in the future. And then I really don't want to say a lot more about this, because I think I'm saying something that's pretty obvious, but this is sort of bound very tightly with the whole idea of beings reincarnating. And there's two ways I like to look at this. One is the way that Joseph Goldstein talks about this. When he talks about this, he says, don't take reincarnation as a dogma, you have to believe, or he says, simply suspend disbelief. Simply don't disbelieve that this is true, that beings reincarnate. And then as you go deeper into the practice and deeper into the understanding of the practice and deeper into your own realization process, it becomes obvious. It's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And that's one way to look at it. And the other way, and I think this is equally valid, even if the multiple lifetimes part of that feels uncomfortable, think of your current life. Think of what's happened to you over the last however many years you are old. If I look back at my life, all the different lives I've had in this life, all the different phases and stages and situations, and being this sort of wild hippie guy who was stoned all the time, and then becoming a father and a mortgage holder and bringing up children, and so on, all these steps of my life. These are all different. They feel like different lives, even though I can sort of see in some way how one led to another, and there's this underlying, my nature is there in all of them. We go through many lives in one life. and how your those lives affect one another. They're one grows out of the next, in a sense. So that's another way to think about this idea of we need to be very careful. We have to look at and understand that how we act in the world affects what comes next. It's really straightforward. And this is not, this is like something we all sort of intuitively understand, I think. Two of my teachers at one point were teaching at a juvenile detention center in the Bay Area. And this is like a maximum security juvie. So these are young men who were murderers and highway robbers. I mean, they were like tough, really tough gang members. And they were, they'd been asked to go there and teach, and they weren't sort of getting very far. You know, they would talk and the guys would sort of laugh, but they would kept going and kept going. And they came and they talked about karma and reincarnation. And the main gang leader in their class said, "Oh, you mean what goes around comes around?" And they went, "Yeah, yeah." And it was like all of a sudden this guy just woke up, and then they could make a connection with these people. So it was like something that he, even from his gang warfare tough guy point of view, made sense. What goes around comes around. Yeah. Okay. Then there's this interesting note here. It says, there is father and mother. This is actually a theme in many different teachings in the East, how important it is to acknowledge our parents and acknowledge the fact that without them, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be having this life if those parents hadn't been there. This is difficult for us, however. For many people, this sort of honor thy father and thy mother sort of energy is like, ooh, you know, because some of us have had very difficult relationships with our parents. I'm fortunate. I had very good relationships with my parents, except for one period of time with my father where he was just like, what's wrong with you? You're weird. You're getting weird. You're growing long hair sort of phase I went through. But other than that, we were very close. I was very close with both my parents, and it was a very tight family. But I know a lot of people have had difficult family relationships. And so this doesn't mean you have to love them or even like them, I suppose. But you have to sort of honor the fact that they brought you into the world and took care of you when you were totally helpless. Think about little babies, how totally helpless they are. So they put some energy into bringing you into the world and did the best they could. And at the same time, and this is where we need to be careful, you know, we get excited about the Dharma. We get excited about the teachings of the Buddha. We get excited about our practice. And we think, that's what my family needs. They need to understand the Dhamma. And this can get us into lots of trouble very quickly. So it's okay to share the Dhamma with them, but do it very sort of gently, little tiny bit. And if it's like, they just like, oh no, I don't want to go there. And this isn't necessarily just your parents. This could be your brothers and your sisters or your close family. We don't ever want to proselytize. We don't ever want to say, you know, I figured out the right way. And maybe even imply, and by the way, that means you've got the wrong way. It doesn't work. If it's okay to talk about it, sort of, if they're interested, if they ask questions, you answer the questions honestly. But I really think the best way to affect our families and honor them, as the sutta suggests, is just by being who we are. And if we're genuinely practicing the Dhamma, they're going to notice what a wonderful person you are, because the Dhamma changes us. And that's often the only thing we can do. Just be who you are and let that light of the Dhamma shine out. And they'll notice, for sure, without having to convince them, without even maybe mentioning it, that that's what you're doing, other than if they ask directly. Just let it be. And then this next section, this other section here, there are beings who are reborn spontaneously. They are in the world, good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who realize for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and other worlds. This is a really interesting thing to think about, that right now in the world there are enlightened beings. It's not like this only happened back then in history. You know, 2,000, 2,500 years ago, oh sure, there was lots of enlightened beings because they all got to, you know, practice with the Buddha, blah, 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 blah. Right now in the world, there are beings that are enlightened and extremely wise. And we have to sort of go, oh yeah, that's true. And we have to acknowledge this partly so we, if we can, tune into these people. I've had the great good fortune to hang out with a few people like this at various times, hang out and practice with, study with, who are clearly, I don't know if they're, I don't think they're enlightened, who knows, but they certainly understood something, understand things that I just don't grasp yet. It's really clear to me that they had something that I didn't know about yet. And this isn't to put myself down. It's just, boy, it was like a privilege to be with these people and to practice with them and study with them. What a gift it was for me to be with them. But I want to actually read something from Joseph. This is from Joseph Goldstein. And this is where he's talking about this topic. Our egalitarian values, you know, all men are created equal, right? Can sometimes diminish the understanding that there are actually people wiser than ourselves. People from whom we can genuinely learn about the Dharma, the truth, the way things are. Acknowledging this also keeps us open to wisdom from unexpected sources. We learn to listen for that voice of genuine experience rather than being influenced positively or negatively by personality or position. Sounds like our culture, huh? Recognizing that there are genuinely wise and awakened beings in the world helps us to reaffirm the understanding that wisdom and awakening are possible for us as well. That's really important. It's like, it's a confirmation that it's possible. It's not just for others. We can practice applying various aspects of mundane right view in different ways. Some may be obvious to us, like the practice of generosity, which bears wholesome fruit, or investigating our motivations and acting on the wholesome and letting go of the unwholesome. Other aspects of this right view may not be immediately apparent. We may have to experiment to see how they affect the quality of our lives. So all of these things I've been talking about, think of them all as experiments. I think I love that idea that Joseph comes back. This is a fairly common theme in Joseph's teaching that I've sort of adopted in my own life and teaching. And that's that all of this is just an experiment. And for some people, some of you, what I just said about parents, for instance, might be like, yeah, not going to go there. And that's okay. It isn't like, oh, I have to do all these things. We have to find the things that work for us. Maybe it's more, you know, contemplating and trying to get a better understanding of reincarnation and what it means to have lives that the energy that we're putting out into the world continues on in the world in some form, somehow. Not the energy of our personality, but the energy of our actions. Our personality, it's going to go. Sorry. Barry isn't going to exist after he dies. He's gone. But the energy of my practice goes on. That's what's important. So that's... yes. And then in this sutta I'm reading from, the Buddha says one other thing. He's talking about, right at the beginning, I said there was these two kinds of view. There's the right view with taints and the right view without taints. And what bhikkhus is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path? The wisdom, the faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, the investigation of state's enlightenment factor, the path factor of right view is one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right view that is noble, taintless, supramundane, a factor of the path. One makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. This is one's right effort. Mindfully, one abandons wrong view. Mindfully, one enters upon and abides in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three states run and circle around right view. That is, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness. So he's talking about the reason we practice. The reason we practice is to attain enlightenment. That's the only reason to practice. And it's important that we don't ever forget that. It's so easy to sort of become satisfied with something less. Like, this practice is making me a better person, or it's making me happier. These are lesser goals. And as we keep our mind focused, we have to keep our mind focused on the fact that this is the practice of liberation. And these other things, happiness, being a quote good person, a better person, sort of just arise out of that, out of the practice itself. As we go deeper and deeper into the practice, we just naturally become happier. We naturally become a person that affects the world in a more positive way, just because we're living the practice. That in and of itself creates that energy. Some more Joseph Goldstein here. And what monks is right view? It is monks, the knowledge of dukkha, the knowledge of the origin of dukkha, the knowledge of the cessation of dukkha, the knowledge of the way of practicing leading to the cessation of dukkha. This is called right view. Oh, look, there's the first three things, right, that we've been talking about. And the Buddha is very clear here. He's saying this is right view, is understanding the nature of dukkha, how it arises, and how it ceases. The Buddha is so clear about emphasizing the importance of right view in promoting the welfare of beings. Bhikkhus, I do not see even a single thing on account of which unarisen wholesome qualities arise and arisen wholesome qualities increase. Sounds pretty good, right? Unarisen wholesome qualities arise and arisen wholesome qualities increase and expand so much as right view. Very strong statement. It's like, this is right view, is takes us in the right direction, and then these things will naturally, actually, as he says, these unarisen wholesome qualities start to arise, and arisen ones increase. That's the essential nature of right view. Right. And then it goes on, this is Joseph Goldstein saying, mindfulness of the truth, of the Four Noble Truths, is in fact the last set of instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta. So that's the very last thing in the practice. Isn't that interesting? As the Buddha describes the step-by-step-by-step-by-step practice, the last thing is to really, as it says, know as it really is, this is dukkha. To really understand that, not at some intellectual level, but at some deep, visceral level. And this is just an act of constantly remembering this. Don't forget this. This is important that we actually remember. And remember that the word sati, which is often translated as mindfulness, another translation of that same word sati is remembering. Often what we're doing is remembering these things. Constantly going, oh yeah, it's important I remember this. And I want to say one more thing about view, and then I'm going to move on. And this is interesting as well, I think. There's another teaching called the 10 Unwholesome Acts of Body, Speech, and Mind. And the very last of these things, of unwholesome acts of mind, is wrong view. It's unwholesome. It's like, that's how strong the Buddha puts it. Wrong view leads us in the wrong direction. Wrong view, in a sense, corrupts the practice and corrupts our minds. That's pretty strong language for me, but that's what happens. It's like, it's really important. Wrong view is the last and probably the strongest thing we have to watch for in unwholesome states of body, speech, and mind. So that's view. Then we come to right intention, or sometimes translated as right thought, the second step on the Eightfold Path. And it's sort of, they sort of fit together kind of nicely. Like, we form right view. We sort of say, that's the direction I want to go in. This is where I want to go. And then right intention says, and okay, now I have to actually consciously choose to do that. I have to sort of motivate myself to move in that direction. I can't just sort of think, oh, wouldn't that be nice? Or maybe I should. I actually now have to do something about it. And that's what right intention gives us, the impetus to practice diligently. So now the question is, well, how do I form this right intention? How do I get there? We've talked a lot about how we can get the right view. How do we get the right intention? So first of all, we have to understand that intention is a mental formation. It's something that arises just like loving kindness and calm and mindfulness and concentration. This is just another mental formation. And in fact, every act we take, every act of body, speech, and mind that we take must be preceded by intention. Other than automatic reactive things, bodily sensation things that happen. And once we understand that, the intention isn't sort of some neutral thing. Intention can either be wholesome or unwholesome. There's a very the famous teaching about this idea of intention. There was in the area where the Buddha spent time and the Buddha spent a lot of time just walking, going from one village to the next teaching. And sometimes accompanied with a whole sangha of monks, and sometimes all by himself. So this is at some point he's just walking along, and he's by himself, and he's heading off into this sort of forested area. And the villagers of the village he's just passing through, he kept saying, "Oh, don't go there! Don't go there! That's where Angulimala lives." And Angulimala is it's horrible, and he's a vicious killer and a thief and a murderer. And you don't want to go there. And the Buddha's going, that's okay. He's going to go there anyway. So, and by the way, Angulimala means a finger necklace. And Angulimala was famous for, after he murdered somebody, cutting off one of their fingers and adding it to his necklace. And he'd found out that the Buddha was coming he was in the neighborhood, and he had it at this point, according to the story, 999 fingers on his necklace, and he wanted the Buddha's finger. Thought here to be the glory of his necklace. Would he get one of the Buddha's fingers and put it on his necklace? Oh, it'll just be great. So the people are all saying, no, don't go there. And the Buddha's just walking along. He's just heading along, and sure enough, he's walking in this secluded place, and Angulimala sees him, and he goes, "Oh, there's that guy whose finger I want." He's like, "There's the guy who's gonna finish my necklace, right?" And the Buddha's just walking, very calm, very still, walking practice, and Angulimala starts to run to catch him. But the problem is, no matter how fast Angulimala runs, he can't catch the Buddha. Even though the Buddha is just walking, he just, somehow or other, he can never quite catch up. And finally he yells, "Stop, stop, stop. I don't understand what's going on here." And the Buddha stops. And the Guru says, "Look, I've been chasing you for like forever, and I can't catch you, and it doesn't make sense. Tell me what's going on." And the Buddha teaches him the Dhamma. Right there in the middle of the forest, just the two of them. He teaches Angulimala, and Angulimala gives up his former life completely and becomes a student of the Buddha's. His intention shifts just like that, from murdering the Buddha to studying with the Buddha, to becoming his disciple. But so he had pretty, I suppose you'd call it, unwholesome intention. And then it shifted to a wholesome one, I'm going to study the Dhamma, and I'm going to, according to the Sutta, eventually, after some great difficulty, because he got into a lot of trouble, because he was a student of the Buddha's, people wouldn't hurt him anymore, but they would do things like, he'd be on rounds with his begging bowl, and then put cow dung in his begging bowl and stuff like that, just anything they could to bother him. And the Buddha would say, oh no, and he would complain to the Buddha and would say, no, I'm sorry. This is, you're just living out the consequences of your actions. Oh, here we are again, consequences of your actions. And you just have to accept this. And eventually, actually, according to the teachings, Angulimala became an enlightened being. So even someone like that can become an enlightened being. He had a great deal of concentration to begin with. I mean, he was pretty good at what he was doing, murdering people and cutting off their fingers. So he knew how to concentrate. He just shifted his intention. He just shifted his intention. It's interesting. Anyhow, but traditionally, the three things we need to do to deepen our intention is we want to cultivate renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. We want to cultivate them. In other words, these are practices. The first of these, and this is very traditional, is renunciation. Well, the thing about the word, I know you hear the word renunciation and people go, doesn't sound that great. How unpleasant, There's a famous little story. There's just, one of these sort of cartoonish sort of things where there's this guy climbing up the side of a mountain and he finally gets up to the top and there's this, man in a robe and long white hair is sitting in front of a cave and the man goes up and he says, great teacher, can you tell me how to reach enlightenment? And the wise man says, practice the path of renunciation. And the guy sort of looks around the top of the mountain and eventually says, is there anyone else up here I can talk to? That's sort of how we feel about renunciation, right? It's like, ooh. But actually, renunciation in our culture also has a bad reputation because a lot of so-called renunciates have acted quite poorly, over the last 50 or 60 years since these teachings started to come to the West. And so we associate renunciation with these guys who pretend to be renunciates and then act out in very unwholesome ways. But the thing with renunciation is all we need to do is form the intention to shift what it is that we do to things that are more wholesome, that are probably more practice oriented. We have to renounce some things that we normally think of as fun, things that give us pleasure, things that we think will make us happy. Because at some level, we understand. We already have that understanding. We know that those things ultimately won't give us the pleasure we're looking for. Inevitably, they will not because they're all impermanent. And so we have to renounce some of these things. So that's what the Buddha means when he talks about renunciation and how important it is. As soon as we take this intention to practice, we're forming the intention to renounce other things. If I'm going to have time to practice every day, if I'm going to have time to practice to go on retreat, if I have time to practice to go to sanghas in the evening, and if I'm going to have time to do all that, then we're all busy all the time, right? That's our culture. I have to give up stuff that I'm doing now to make room for these other things that I see as more important. That's just the nature of what we've chosen to do. And the beauty of it is, the more we practice and the more we see our lives changing and the wholesomeness and the happiness of the practice, the easier it becomes to renounce more. To let go of more things and just put more energy into practice. It's a it's a feedback loop. That's the word. It's a feedback loop that we practice and we get something, holds something wonderful starts to happen, and we start to feel this happiness of the practice. The Dhamma starts to shine through us. And then renunciation is like, oh, the joy of renunciation. Isn't this great? It becomes a joy. Hard as it is to sort of take in, that's what it becomes, a joy. And you actually see in places in the sutta the Buddha talking about the joy of renunciation. This isn't easy. I'll make that very clear. This isn't easy. You all know that too, I'm sure. It's like, we know that this is difficult because we're going against the stream of the culture. The stream of the culture says, oh, if you want to be happy, just find as many things as you can that are pleasurable and try and push away all the things that are unpleasant. That's the cultural belief on how to be happy. And we have right understanding. We see that's not true. If you didn't already have at least some level of that understanding, you wouldn't be sitting here listening to me talk. But you know that. Now it's just, let's put this understanding into practice by forming the intention to practice ardently and diligently, to really settle in and do this. And it becomes, in the end, the practice has to become the most important thing in your life. That's has to be the intention. And that's a gradual thing. I'm not saying, you know, tomorrow, but gradually over time, it becomes, this is what's more important than anything else. That this is the prime motivator in my life. But just Joseph, of course, Joseph Goldstein has many things to say about this. This is from his book, Mindfulness, again. The question for us is how to put this step on the path into practice, right? How to make this practical, how to make this part of our practice. In one discourse of the middle-length discourses called The Two Kinds of Thoughts, the Buddha suggests one way to begin. Cultivate a clear discernment of the kinds of thoughts that arise in our minds. We can notice which thoughts are rooted in desire, ill will, or cruelty. Consciously reflect on the karma that they cause, and then abandon them, letting them go. And we can notice those thoughts inclining towards renunciation, goodwill, and compassion, reflect on their value, and their strength, and then strengthen them in our lives. All of this is wise reflection in service of the path. As we become more mindful of these two classes of thoughts, we also become aware of the strength and seductive powers of the unwholesome patterns. Ill will and aversion are said to be more dangerous than greed, but easier to uproot, whereas desire is less dangerous, but harder to uproot. Why is this? Ill will has more harmful consequences, but it is always unpleasant, and the suffering of it is obvious. Right? When we're caught in thoughts of ill will, we're always pretty miserable. We're just like, if we tune in at all, it's like, ugh. You know, it's like, I'm being grumpy and it doesn't feel good. Being grumpy being a mild form of ill will, right? Sense desires, on the other hand, are usually associated with pleasure. And it's not always apparent why renouncing them is a good idea. It's an interesting thought, huh? It isn't always obvious that renouncing them is a good idea. Here's another thing Joseph says. A more accurate and liberating understanding of renunciation would be as an experience of non-addiction. We all know the suffering bound up with addictions, whatever they might be. We might be addicted in one way or another to food, drugs, sex, alcohol, or perhaps more unnoticed to work, power, recognition, wealth, or even comfort. We can become addicted to and entranced by certain mind states and emotions, like excitement or intensity or fear. You know, witness the very big audience for terrifying horror movies. Meditators can also get addicted to different meditative states, like rapture or calm. How often in our practice are we trying to recreate some experience we've had before? We can get addicted to investigation. We can become overly fascinated with everything we're discovering. At one point in my practice in Burma, when I had been there for several months, the mindfulness had become very sharp, and I was seeing extremely minute details about what was arising. When I reported this to the teacher, thinking that things were going really well, all he said to me was, you're too attached to subtlety. Oh, whoops, here I am. Here's this subtle form of attachment that's arisen. It was a powerful reminder that the practice is about renunciation, about letting go. So this idea of renouncing, of letting go, very important. And then the other two things on this list I'm not going to talk so much about, but loving kindness and compassion. These are how to set our intention in the right direction. If we can set the intention to act from a place of loving kindness towards others, then naturally compassion will arise. Yeah. Compassion is this loving kindness directed toward those who are suffering. But that's the Theravada view anyway. You know, other Buddhist teachings might have a slightly different idea of that. But in the Theravada tradition, loving kindness is the root of everything. And then when we discover suffering in another being, compassion will just naturally arise. It's just a form of loving kindness almost. And the beauty of loving kindness and compassion is it's because we start to feel the interconnectedness of all beings. We start to see that we're not separate. The more we set our intention towards living a life of loving kindness and compassion, the less we feel separate from others. The less we feel separate from others, the more we start to actually realize that we're not, that we really aren't separate at all, that this idea that I'm sort of separate being gets eroded away simply by filling our mind with these wholesome thoughts. That's right intention. Let's move in that direction. Let's have thoughts of renunciation, of loving kindness and compassion. That's the direction our intention takes us. And out of that, we get this connection with all beings. We start to actually experience our interconnectedness, as opposed to it being some theoretical thing we believe in. Though we need that belief to start often. That's that right understanding part. The right understanding leads to the right intention, where we start to actually try and live that out, express that in our lives. So that's almost all I have to say, except I, of course, have a poem to read. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going and In. And this is speaking primarily to what I just said. It's called Surely This Is Love. Great title for a poem. I am intimately connected with all that is. When you water your roots, my heart blossoms. When I see you smile, that's when I know I'm fully alive. As you are able to live in truth, I raise the roof on this house I am exploring. I throw the doors wide, let the breeze blow in the windows. When you grow, I know it is my own opening. You stretch, I breathe. You give, and I receive. Just beneath the fabric of our lives, coiled, ready to spring, or budding like a rose, reaching out to embrace, or sitting bathed in grace and stillness, this singing, circling, radiant, one with everything. Surely, this is love. May the beneficial energies arising from my practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.